actually asked on the comments what I think about the issue of pronouncing the name. So first of all, Keith Johnson calls me up. I love the man, really. I mean, he's a wonderful guy. I mean, I'm blessed by just knowing him. And calls me up and he says, you know, oh, I don't see a ban on the, I don't see what you said, some of the stuff you said on the Hanukkah show, where you said it, you don't see a ban on the name. And the answer is yes. I did not see a ban on the name inside the text. I've read the Book of Maccabees. But we do know from other information that something like that did happen. To what extent, we don't know. But the issue of banning the name, I mean, it has more layers to it, because it was Saul Lieberman wrote that. I think I mentioned this in the Hanukkah show. Saul Lieberman wrote about the fact that the Greeks had this issue of not pronouncing their deities' names at one point, and it affected the Jewish world. And you know, there's a lot, you know, by around the first century BC. The group of Qumran, we call them the Qumran cult, Qumran sect, they had in their books, they had this prohibition of saying the name in any form, shape, or way, in a prayer, in a blessing, reading from the scriptures. No, there was a prohibition. It became very very deep in the culture. So, but saying that there was no ban on the name is not 100% true, but saying there was a ban on the name by the Greeks, I don't know if that's true either. I mean, I look at the Book of Maccabees, I don't see it. I mean, I read through the prohibitions they had there. It was very, very specific. But that doesn't matter. There's still a ban on the name. Now, someone asked you if I agree with Nehemiah about the pronunciation and everything. I want to clarify something. Orthodox Jews do not pronounce the name. It's just taboo. You do not do that. It's to such an extent where the rabbis basically said, if you do that, you have no part in the world to come. That's how extreme it is.
Wow.
You know, even saying the consonants that form the name is forbidden if you say them in order. So there's a lot of people are scared of the name.
Even pronouncing the Tetragrammaton is a forbidden thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's that extreme. It is that extreme. We reached a point where even saying Adonai and Elohim is there's a prohibition that you have to say, you know, Hashem, the name. The word Hashem basically means the name. Someone who says Adonai, they'll get very angry with them. Someone who says Elohim, you have to say Elohim. No, you have to change the her to a ka.
And it's not just that too, because I've noticed on various occasions that they'll even remove letters out of generic terms like God and Lord.
Yeah. English-speaking Jews, well, they write the word God, they'll remove the O. They'll do a G and then a comma and then a D, which is, it's even more stupid. But that's how it's done in the Jewish world. It's become ridiculous. I mean, from coming from an Orthodox background and everything, you look through the older writings, you look through Maimonides, you look through a Talmud, you do not see anything like that. You do not see anything like that. It does not exist. So, you know, with all due respect to people's traditions and background and everything, there's a point where traditions have to be stopped. Okay? It has to be stopped at one point, and people are slowly in Israel understanding that. But there is a war going on regarding traditions. You know, we're having these stories about mistreating women in the Orthodox world. First of all, let me just pop this balloon for a second. It's not as extreme as people are describing it. Okay, the whole issue is that in the Orthodox world, specifically ultra-Orthodox in the Hasidic groups, okay, there's the people have this confusion where Hasidic, non-Hasidic, you know, there's Hasidic is one type of ultra-Orthodox Jews. There's non-Hasidic known as Litvish. That's Nehemiah's background. That's my background. We're not from the Hasidic groups. But maybe we should also do a lesson regarding different groups in Judaism, how they developed.
Sure. Yeah.
We can do that. If people want a lesson on that, please press 1. seriously, if you leave in the comment section, if we see enough, please have a lesson on that. Gladly, we'll do a lesson on that.
But this has been making the headlines lately, hasn't it? The whole thing with the ultra-Orthodox having a go at women and the segregation and the modesty and the sitting at the back and all of this sort of stuff. And it's been making international headlines. Is it really that big an issue in Israel?
You don't walk in the street, it's going to happen. I mean, for example, you have tourists go through Mash Harim, which is one of the super strongholds, one of the oldest ultra-Orthodox communities in Jerusalem, and women walk through there with trousers, no one does anything. Mm-hmm. Okay? And if it doesn't happen there, then it's just nonsense. But there is something going on in a place called Beit Shemesh. Beit Shemesh is just outside Jerusalem, about half an hour drive from Jerusalem. And one of the problems they have there is these places are taken over by ultra-Orthodox Jews. Mm-hmm. And what happens is they have very extreme opinions. These are Hasidic groups. I mean, I've seen pictures of them. These are Hasidic groups. So there's, first of all, in the Hasidic groups, there's not enough strong leadership. I mean, there is the Rebbe, the big Hasidic rabbi. But really, everyone does whatever they want. In the other world, the world that Chemi and I come from, the background we come from, there's always a rabbi. He tells you what to do. Now, it doesn't tell you. You stop thinking. It does not exist. But they make their opinion very, very clear. So people do what they say. And, for example, the Litvish rabbis say, it doesn't matter. So what? It's not our business to stuff our nose into other people's business. It's not ours to do. The Hasidim, on the other hand, are a lot more extreme because that's the whole idea of being Hasidic. Doing things outside of your actual capabilities. That's part of the Hasidic mindset, where you do extra. You do more. Even if you're a boorish person and you don't know anything, you're going to do the most strict ways of doing everything. I mean, you can't, I don't know, you can't control yourself and you have to forcefully control yourself. Now, there's a book that came out almost 300 years ago called Mesilat Yesharim, which is a very, very good book. It was written by an Italian Jew. His name was Luzzatto. Some people might know who that was, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, known as the Ramchal. And he wrote a book called Mesilat Yesharim, Mesilat Yesharim could be translated as the roughly translated, if we do a literal translation, would be the path of the straight.
Okay.
And the whole book basically works on the idea of how to develop yourself as becoming more and more pious and more and more strict with things. But he always says you can't. You know, we have a saying in the Talmud. It says, "Lo amaretz chassid." A boorish man cannot be pious because he doesn't know. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know what to do with it. He doesn't have an understanding. So this is why, I mean, I every time people ask me about should I be more strict about this, should I do this, should I do that, and I always tell them you have to think where you are standing. Where are you now in your personal development? A man in his 20s can be very, very pious. True, but that also has to do with personality. If you were raised in a very non-religious world, and you hit 20 and you decide you're going to be religious, and in 1 year you're practicing all these very strict ways of doing things, you're going to crash. And I've seen this happen dozens of times.
Yeah, look, I can relate to what you're saying. I remember when I was still in the tradition where I came from, and all of a sudden I decided I wanted to take my faith seriously, and I became very zealous at the time. And all of a sudden, when I was very casual, had a very casual faith, all of a sudden it was very, very, very serious. And people, I kind of scared a lot of people off.
It happened to me as well. I was raised in the Orthodox world, raised with a lot of strict things. It's a lot easier for me to do certain things. I mean, my ability to know, if something's forbidden, it's forbidden. That's it. And you will not see me do it. But that really has to do with mental development from a very, very young age. I mean, when I was 2 years old, I was told certain things. When I was 3 years old, then I was told other things. By the age of six, you know a lot of the rules of Judaism. Mm-hmm. By the age of 10, you know more. By the age of 15, you know so much, it's almost scary. By the age of 18, 20, you just have this very wide grasp of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You have if you don't know anything to depth, you still have a basic idea of how it works.
Sure.
So for me, becoming more strict was very, very easy. It was just the next stage. But you learn that being strict is not always the solution. It's not always the right way to go. Sometimes what people think is the right way to go and it's a lot more strict will be the wrong way to go. And that's specifically what's going on here. There is no prohibition. Let me be very, very blunt about something. I want to be very clear. In the Torah, there's no prohibition of looking at women. You know, if she's married, then you're not being lustful. But if you're talking with a woman, okay, this is the big difference. A woman walks up to you and asks you a question. What is the most normal thing to do? You don't start looking her up and down, obviously, even if she's not married. But it's a courtesy to look at least at the person when you're talking with them, because if you turn your heads around, it's kind of insulting. People need communication. That's number one. Sure. Number two, you speak with her. You answer what you need to answer. And if it's someone you know, there's nothing saying you know that to say, switch a few words. How are you? How's the family? How are the kids? Stuff like that. On the other hand, in the ultra-Orthodox world, it really depends who it is, because you always have your individuals. But in the ultra-Orthodox world, exchanging of words is very cold. There are people who do not look at women when they talk with them, and there are people who won't even talk with women.
Wow.
I one day received a phone call, and it was a lady on the other end, and she needed to know something. I was the one who actually was supposed to answer that question, but she asked to speak with my wife. Why? Because she didn't want to speak with me.
So she was an ultra-Orthodox woman.
She was an ultra-Orthodox woman, and she knows exactly who I am and everything, but she wanted to speak with my wife because she didn't want to speak with me.
When I
told her my wife is not available, then you know, she spoke with me anyhow.
So she spoke with you reluctantly. But did this kind of come to the headlines? If I remember correctly, it was several months ago when a number of members of the IDF refused to attend a performance of a woman singing, even. Is that how this all erupted? And then I assume from that they were ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah. So first of all, ultra-Orthodox Jews do not really serve in the army. I mean, I served in the unit where it's supposed to be special for ultra-Orthodox Jews, and there were none. Nothing.
Really? You know,
everyone was just either Orthodox or semi-religious. There were no ultra-Orthodox Jews there. Basically what happened, first of all, this has been going on for years. I mean, this stuff has been going on for years, but it's erupting slowly now. First, you have to remember, the media is blowing this out of proportion. Just to be very clear, the media is completely blowing this out of proportion. There were several incidents. It's very, how would I explain this? It's not as big as people think. It's very small, but it's there, and it's just making everyone very, very angry. And for years already, we've had issues. For example, women's just in the back of the bus, men's just in the front of the bus, you know. And I've always made an issue that if a woman wants to sit down next to me, I do either one or two things. Either I let her sit down next to me, and I just don't care, because there's no prohibition on such a thing. There's even an answer by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein from the U.S. From years ago. We wrote, there's a bus, okay, so it's a mixed area. There's nothing you can do about it. So if you by mistake touch a woman, it's not the end of the world. You're not going to burn in hell for it. That's the essence of what he said.
Right.
It's not the words he used, but that's the essence of what he said.
Sure.
And there was a time several years ago that I would, you know, if a woman had to sit down, and it doesn't matter how old she was, she could be in her 20s even, you know, I just get up and give her my seat, you know, sit.
Sure.
She said, but why are you sitting down? I said, we usually don't sit next to women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I used to jump when a woman, for example, would tap my shoulder or touch my arm to show me something. I used to like, no, don't do that. And I learned in time that, you know, you're not going to burn in hell. And basically, I started looking through the Talmud. I started looking through things, and I noticed something very, very simple, that they did have a prohibition of touching women, but it wasn't as extreme as it's done today. There was an understanding you don't touch women, women don't touch men, but it was just not as extreme as today.
Now, this
when
reminds me.
When it was necessary, then it was done.
It reminds me of the scene in Fiddler on the Roof where Perchik decides that he wants to dance with a woman, that it's not a crime to dance with a woman. Ask the rabbi, he says. And the rabbi says, well, it's not exactly, and then they interrupt him. But I think what he might have been able to say, maybe you can speculate on this, would it have stemmed from the laws of Nida, for example, not to touch a woman?
That would be one of them. That actually would be one of the major ones. Was a very old practice in different cultures not to touch women when they're in the middle of the nida. So yes, that's part of it.
Okay.
That might have been the original spark for it. But in time, you know, they absorbed a lot of the other cultures which were around them, specifically from the Persians. And it became there was a prohibition of touching women. But look at the Bible itself. Look in the Bible itself, that women touching men there, or men touching women.
Yep.
You don't see anything prohibiting that. Mm. Now, for example, one of the big arguments, for example, a woman slips in the street and she falls on the ground, and you're the only guy in the area. The Talmud itself even states, she is like your sister at that time. You have to help her up.
Mm.
And if you have to pick her up to take her to a hospital or something, you do that. No, there's like a balance they kept. I mean, there are situations where it doesn't matter. She slipped, she fell, she broke her ankle, she hit her leg, whatever it would be, you help her up. Mm. But I've been in situations when that happens, and I was about to approach her to help her up. I mean, I'm pretty strong, so, you know, if I have to pick her up and put on a bench or something, I can do that. Mm. And this one lady had it happen to her. She said, no, don't touch me, don't touch me. I was like, madam, you've injured your leg, and there's no one around. No, I'll be okay. And she somehow managed to get up and dragged herself.
Wow.
And I'm like, you're insane. No, that's being pious without having to be pious.
Let me ask you a question. I should let everybody know, first of all, you're listening to Truth to You Radio. We are speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo, my Hebrew teacher. And it seems we're talking about the current situation in Israel and the international news media exposure that it's getting, the issue of men touching women and the protests from the ultra-Orthodox and so on and so forth. That's causing quite a stir. I just wanted to ask you, as you spent time in yeshiva during your 20s, as you obviously take your faith very seriously, was there a time as an Orthodox Jew that you considered transitioning to what might be regarded as an ultra-Orthodox Jew? Was that ever something on your mind?
Not only that it was on my mind, it actually happened.
Really?
When I started serious yeshiva when I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the army after about 2 years of being in yeshiva. That's the normal practice.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the army for a shorter period than everyone else because I got married to the army. Just decided there's no point in keeping a married man who's no longer in combat anymore as a soldier, so they released me.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home. It was regular Orthodox, everything. And when I reached around the age of 23, I decided the right way to go was to become ultra-Orthodox. I was ultra-Orthodox for about 6 or 7 years. The process started already when I was like 22, but it mm-hmm. took time until it actually happened.
What was the catalyst for that decision? I mean, was it as simple as deciding you're going to become ultra-Orthodox? I mean, was it such a simple thought in your head?
When you're seeking to do God's will, you're always looking, you're always checking, you're always trying to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I started developing a very good relationship with a friend of mine. We're still good friends, but we've distanced ourselves from one another for the past 2 years because he moved out of the neighborhood, so I don't see him that much. But mm-hmm. we've also developed a very different mindset. I mean, when I first met him, I was like 21, 22. I was still a kid.
But in your zeal, you had studied and studied and studied. So
we're talking about days where studying started at 8 o'clock in the morning and then ended around somewhere like 10 o'clock at night.
Mm.
And it was a straight. It was you finish the day, your head is bursting with information, and you have to take breaks every once in a while. That's what people do.
And were such days because you were transitioning to the ultra Orthodox world, or did that change when you decided to transition to the ultra Orthodox world? How did that change you in as far as study was concerned?
You just take everything a lot more seriously. The whole premise of the idea of becoming ultra-Orthodox was based on the idea of that this is the right way to go. These are the people who kept the Torah throughout the centuries, la-di-la-di-la-di-la. But the break happened, and I want to cut this story short because we're supposed to talk about Shabbat today. but it's a very good introduction because we have mm-hmm. to talk about Shabbat, and there's pieces of information about Shabbat that people now understand after this part of the conversation. But one of the things that happens is that what thing that happened was I sat down to read the history of the ultra-Orthodox world, and something dawned on me, something that I knew but I never paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
The ultra-Orthodox idea has been around for about 200 years, and it was a response to the Reform movement, the groups in Germany that started becoming more academic and started abandoning Judaism mm-hmm. and the Reform movement. And that was really it. And when you look into the history of Judaism before around the 1700s, people were just Jewish. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
But this ultra-Orthodox idea has literally ripped Judaism to pieces. Now, I'm not saying only them. I mean, the secular world has ripped Judaism to pieces as well. But we're dealing today in a world where people just grew up secular. There's no ideology behind it. There's no idea why are we secular. Just secular, because that's how they grew up. So they have to see the nicer side of Judaism, the more appealing side of Judaism, to enable them to enter back into Judaism, to enter back into the covenant of the Torah. That's something that – this is why I go so upset with this whole story. But the problem is now it's becoming violent from the other end as well. There's actually a photographer – who has been arrested for attacking an ultra-Orthodox girl, spitting on her. Oh, so goodness. It's becoming double-sided. And people are telling me now the seculars are becoming very violent towards them. And I said, no, this is damage. This is real damage to the Jewish world.
It is, but of course the media likes to take hold of, of these things, and they really like to take the ultra-Orthodox Jew and paint them as a representative of all of Israel. And it gets a lot of, I suppose in that sense, borderline anti-Semitic media, I would say. But it's not just that. Of course, the other thing that has been getting a lot of media, even over here, is the rock throwing at cars on Shabbat.
Oh, that's a side issue. Let's not even go there. It's silly.
But at the same time, is it fair to say that this is an expression of the ultra-Orthodox as well?
This is, but it's not. It used to be worse in the 80s. In the 80s, it was really bad. Early 90s, it was really bad. Mm. It's changed. It's changed. The rabbis have understood that it's very problematic to do that. The reality here has changed. People are softening up a bit, and people are becoming a bit harder. We'll see what happens. In time, we'll see what happens. But what I want to change at the moment here is what I want things to see change is the fact that the ultra-Orthodox world has to understand these are secular people, they do not believe like we do, and we have to be a bit more understanding, and they will get the idea eventually. It's not that I support seculars, it's not that I support the idea. I mean, it's just we have to keep a balance. We're still one nation, we're not living in a reality that was 2,000 years ago where people were just very violent to one another. Today, we have to behave very differently. We have to be very accepting and very open. And then in time, it will change. It will change. I mean, a lot of people who are pushed away from Torah, returning to Torah. There's a huge movement of returning to Torah now in Israel. And the ones who don't want to return to Torah become on the other extreme. But it's changed. And the reality here in Israel is changing. The state of Israel, Jews in general in Israel, are becoming more and more religious.
You say that there's a huge percentage of people in Israel returning to Torah. Can you elaborate on that a little?
If we do that, we're not going to reach Shabbat.
We'll get there eventually.
Let's leave it with this, okay? Just understand, there's a lot of propaganda to keeping Shabbat and keeping kosher. 89% of Jews in Israel, 89% of people who were asked in the survey, keep Yom Kippur. No, it's working. It's totally working. But we see also the ones who are very secular, are very open about it, and very clear about it. And television in general, you open up TV programs today, specifically, for example, food programs, and they're showing you about lobsters and mussels and stuff like that. But the thing is, the majority of people here in Israel will not touch this stuff. Okay. There are a lot of non-kosher restaurants, but if, for example, you go to Tel Aviv, you're going to go to Tel Aviv. There's a lot of restaurants where they're not kosher. But really, that's really just in Tel Aviv. You come to Jerusalem, the number of non-kosher restaurants in Jerusalem is tiny. Mm-hmm. If you compare it to the kosher restaurants, almost every restaurant in Jerusalem is kosher.
Okay.
You won't go to the sushi restaurant, because they serve seafood. Fine. But the number of non-kosher restaurants in Jerusalem is extremely small.
So you mentioned the observance of Yom Kippur, the observance of kosher laws, the food laws, and we're promised everybody that we're going to talk about Shabbat. Do you observe that there are more people in Israel that are observing Shabbat?
Well, that depends on how do you explain what it means to observe Shabbat.
That's what we're going to talk about.
Now that you hear the mindset of the ultra-Orthodox world, being very strict about things, mm-hmm. now you have a bit of understanding of what goes on in the Orthodox world and the ultra-Orthodox world when it comes to Shabbat. Mm-hmm. So first of all, let's start dealing a bit of issue with words. What exactly the word Shabbat means? Now, obviously, I think a lot of people here listening to this program actually know what the word Shabbat means, but we're going to look at a few words and then we're going to try to explain them as well. So first of all, the word Shabbat. The word Shabbat itself is like the word shevet, to sit. So Shabbat would be from the word lishbot, if we turn into it in basically a verbal form, but it's when you add the lamed, it's infinitive, so it basically means to stop, basically using the word to and then to stop, to rest, not specific in time, gender, or anything like that. So it means to stop. That's it. Why do we call it to stop? Because when the world was created in the book of Genesis, it says that God ceased from doing the work of creation and rested. What does it mean God rested? I don't know, okay? What does it mean? What do you mean rest in a reality where it's not physical? So It's a very, very good question.
It is, but
Probably not be able to answer in this reality.
So I've got it open in front of me, and this is Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Thus the heavens and the earth and all the hosts of them were finished, and on the seventh day God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Verse 3, then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. He blessed it and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. And it seems like in those three verses, whatever it meant that God rested, I mean, how we go about describing that, who knows, but it certainly seems that he was setting a precedent that the seventh day is for rest. He was setting an example for that for us. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's really part of it. Basically, if you look at Shabbat, it has several layers. It has the spiritual layer like this, God rested. It has the more human layer where it talks about us resting, our servants resting, basically slowing things down, calming down to enable our servants to rest, our animals to rest, and more of a civil type of idea, not specifically religious.
Mm-hmm.
There's several aspects to it. There's also the aspect of covenant. You know, Shabbat is it's mentioned in the book of Exodus that it's a covenant between God and Israel. Mm-hmm. It has several ideas in it, and this is why we have to elaborate on this a lot to explain all these ideas. So I'm going to start off first from the technical side.
Sure.
Okay, the do's and don'ts of Shabbat. Then we're probably going to go into the issue of practices of Shabbat, you know, what is done. There's a very common practice of Kabbalat Shabbat. I want to explain that because I've heard a lot of interesting things that people do. I want to explain what it means, how people do it, maybe clarify some of the terms that people misuse in this subject.
Mm-hmm.
We describe what goes on in the Jewish household. Some people know, some people don't. So we're going to try that. That would be probably next time.
Sure.
So the do's and don'ts of Shabbat.
Well, we've read that the verse from Genesis, but just one verse that always comes to mind, and obviously the Ten Commandments is one of them as well in Exodus chapter 20.
That's more the issue of covenant, because if it's on the Ten mm-hmm. Commandments, it's part of the covenant. There was a whole covenant ceremony there.
So it's now written
on stone. So it's basically, the Ten Commandments are basically a document. So the document is mm-hmm. written down, and it's basically the agreement.
And another verse that just comes to mind, and then we'll return to the details of it. Whenever I think of Shabbat, is Ezekiel 20, verse 19 and 20, and it says, I am the Lord your God, walk in my statutes, keep my judgments, and do them. Hallow my Sabbaths, and they will be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. So, it's a sign.
We have
as well
to read that one fully in context, because you're also reading it. It's a plural. Shabbat there is in plural, so it's Shabbatotai.
Mm-hmm.
And that can actually mean also the rest of the festivals.
The festivals as well. Yeah, but including obviously the seventh day. So maybe we'll get back to those a little later.
If you read Leviticus, the chapters that talk about the festivals, Shabbat mm-hmm. is the first list.
Mm, sure. Sure. So, now, let me just say another thing that I found interesting too. We, of course, Genesis chapter 2. But if I remember correctly, and maybe something may come to your mind, but I don't think that we hear about Shabbat again in the book of Bereshit. In fact, I think the next time we...
It's in Exodus.
So we've got to wait till chapter 16 is when it's specifically mentioned.
It's so let me try to focus this on the subject I want to talk about this time.
Okay.
Basically, the do's and don'ts of Shabbat revolve around the word melacha. Now, everyone immediately tries to say, oh, it means work. But how do you define work?
Mm-hmm.
How do you actually define this concept of work? Mm-hmm. So I've heard a lot of interesting practices in the Hebrew Roots Messianic groups, which actually are things we don't allow. So in the Torah itself, there are not too many examples of the concept of work. This develops the assumption that if it's not one thing is that if it's not written, it's not forbidden. That's one thing I heard. And sometimes people do actual work, things which are clearly work during Shabbat, which is a problem. Or that people have their own definition of what work is, mm-hmm. and they say, "Oh, this is not, I'm not working." And they just do something. Or someone goes out to the backyard, "I'm not working." So when we try to define the concept of work, we stumble upon several things that Tanakh itself, for example, working in the field, is one of them. That appears, it says, "B'charish u'b'katzir tishbot." So they understand this is a form of work in the plowing and the harvesting. You shall cease.
So that's a no-brainer.
So you understand everything in between is also forbidden. He's basically describing all the work you do in the field. We have other descriptions, for example, in the book of Nehemiah, where they describe that he saw people carrying things in the street, and they were pressing the vines, and they were doing this, and they were doing that, and that all falls in the category of work. So we see the concept of work. When the Torah said melacha, people knew what it meant. So there's some kind of historical concept here that we have to look at.
And so there is always the question of, if I walk out into my garden and I pull out a weed on Shabbat just because I see it there and I pull it out, is that regarded as work? Have I just have I just sinned? If I do something, for example, that I regard as a restful way to pass the day, others might look at that and go, you know, that's work, you shouldn't be doing that. And so you're right, the definition of work is very, very important. Obviously, the example of the field, it's kind of a no-brainer, because you're out there, you're sowing, you're reaping, you're whatever you may be doing, it has to do with prospering yourself. It has to do with produce. It has to do with all those kind of things. And it's fairly easy to categorize that as work. But then there's other things like toasting bread.
Yeah. There's a lot of like these little things that, how do you deal with them? So let me explain something from the Orthodox mindset. Orthodox mindset, and I know this is not what everyone wants to know. Everyone wants to know what the Bible says. But let me try to define something. The Orthodox mindset, the rabbinical mindset, basically says if it's similar to the type of work, it's also considered to be work. And even if it's a minimum of work, it is still work. So, for example, you're not allowed to pull weeds from a field. Why do you pull weeds out of a field? Because the weeds can take over the field and destroy your crop. Okay, if we're talking about fields of not trees, but other things. So even if it's a minimal amount of work, it's still considered to be work. That's one part of it. The other part of it is if it's similar. So, for example, you want to dig a hole for planting a tree.
Sure.
So you dig a hole, you put the tree in, you cover it with the earth. And that's obviously work. It's work in the field. What happens if, for example, you want to play a game and you have to make a hole in the ground for this game? The rabbinical mindset, that would be work.
Now, I've been told another example of such a thing is in the rabbinical mindset, it is work to squeeze the water from a towel. Ultra-Orthodox don't have showers. And in turn, it's considered work to squeeze a lemon because it's the same action.
You're jumping into small details. I'm trying more to give you the general idea, because if we're going to start dealing with details, we can be talking now for the next 2-3 years. I can give you lessons for the next 2-3 years about Shabbat and the rabbinical mindset. One of the things I do when I teach Hebrew is I don't want to go into all the small details. Okay? There's no point in doing that. What I try to find is the general rules of what is going on here. Why is it like this? Because if you give a student the general idea, then they can actually sit down by themselves. We can actually use our time better. If I'm going to start dealing with, okay, you see this word, you see that word, now you do it like this, you do it like that, and give 9 bazillion examples, the student only has examples. He doesn't have the general idea. I want to give the general idea, because if we go into all the details, I'm telling you, I can fill entire libraries with books just about Shabbat.
Sure.
This is how detailed it is in the Orthodox world. But yes, it's true. There is this thing, you're not allowed to squeeze a towel, not because it's like squeezing a lemon. It's because it's part of what they used to do to wash for laundry. That's the idea. So it's similar. You see this. It's like a pattern. It's similar, therefore, I'm not allowed to do this. For example, squeezing a lemon. Squeezing one lemon or half a lemon, why would that be work? Go and squeezing, pressing a whole batch of olives or grapes for wine or olive oil. That's work. Why is this squeezing this lemon? It's because the mindset of the rabbis, we're talking, this is very old. This is not something new. This is since the Second Temple period. if it's similar, it's forbidden. And that's part of the problem. So It might be a problem, might not be a problem. It really depends how you look at it. But there are places where people start comparing things and saying, okay, this is also forbidden. This is also forbidden. So it's a very complex, very confusing issue. So for example, and this is a classic example, cooking on Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, we forbid cooking. We forbid it based on the verses in about the manna. There's different ways of explaining those verses, by the way. I have to be very, very clear. We had a discussion about this several months ago, you and I, regarding, you know, Moses tells him, go collect two portions because tomorrow he's not going to be in the field. And he says, cook whatever you cook, bake whatever you bake, and whatever is left, leave for the next day. There's two ways of reading these verses, understanding these verses. But one of the issues with those verses is, what does it mean, leave whatever is left for the next day? So we understand, we do, as Orthodox Jews, and I think, if I remember, Karaites also say the exact same thing. I think, if I remember correctly, I also heard it from Nehemiah. He also says the exact same thing, is that they cooked everything, and the next day, they were not allowed to cook anything. They ate whatever they cooked. That's one way of reading it. Another way of reading it is saying, no, they left the raw material, and the next day, they ate it as a raw material, still prohibiting cooking. The third opinion, and this is the more scarce opinion among scholars and Jews, is that they actually cooked the manna during Shabbat. The problem is that in the end of the book of the Exodus, it speaks about not kindling a fire during Shabbat. And one of the basic understandings is that you're not allowed to start the fire, but there's an argument, can you have the fire burning during Shabbat, and can you work with this fire? And the rabbinical understanding is that you're allowed to have the fire burning, you're not allowed to kindle it. most of the Karaites, if not all, say you're not even to have the fire burning during Shabbat, which completely limits the idea of cooking. So can you cook with a microwave? That still has a definition of cooking. So cooking has a very, very specific definition, that basically you're taking a non-edible item and you're making it edible with heat, with cold. It really depends what it is. Cooling something down is not cooking, by the way, because that's not really, we don't look at that as being cooking. But so practice is we don't cook during Shabbat, either from the first verses about the manna or the verses that have to do with fire in the end of the book of Exodus. I think it's Exodus 32, I think, not to kindle fire.
Yes, it is. So I'll just read it for the the listeners. This is Exodus chapter 16, verse 23. First of all, Moses said to them, this is what Yehovah has said.
35, sorry.
Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath unto Yehovah. Bake what you will bake today and boil what you will boil and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. So they laid it up until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you will gather it. But on the seventh day, what they were doing was gathering twice as much on the sixth day. And they had what they would have on the sixth day, and what was left over would not go off because it was the Sabbath. And then in verse
35, verse 3.
So the prohibition of fire says, you shall kindle no fire throughout your dwellings on the Sabbath day. Now, I ought to put that in its context, if that's all right, from verse 1. Then Moses gathered all the congregation of the children of Israel together and said to them, these are the words which the Lord has commanded you to do. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh day shall be holy, a holy day for you, a Sabbath of rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. I mean, that's how serious it is. And then it goes on to say, you shall kindle no fire throughout your dwellings on the Shabbat day. So there's also the...
So there's several there's two opinions regarding this verse. Mm-hmm. The classic opinion is it has nothing to do with work. It has to do with fire itself. Mm-hmm. Philo, for example, in his writings about the laws of Moses, he writes very clearly that the issue of fire is because it has nothing to do with how much work you have to put into actually producing the fire, which takes us back to the issue of the man who was collecting firewood and was
Numbers
executed.
15. Yep.
Yeah. Numbers 15? Oh, Numbers 15. Yeah, Numbers, yes. Numbers is correct. I was thinking Exodus. Why wasn't thinking Exodus? Yeah, so some people link the fire to that, the work around having fire, how much work you have to do to produce fire. That's one opinion. So some people say, this is not a new opinion. This has been around for years already. Mm-hmm. I heard a lot from secular friends of mine. It used to be hard, difficult to produce fire, by the way, which is complete utter nonsense. So it's not that difficult to produce fire in the ancient world. It was not that difficult. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot of work, and you have to collect firewood and sit there for half an hour rubbing these sticks together, which is complete and utter nonsense. Mm. Anyone who's ever done any camping knows you can light a fire in like 2 minutes. It's not that difficult.
Because the fact of the matter would have been that, I mean, if you're starting a fire from scratch, yeah, there's a little bit of effort involved, sure, and maybe you can describe that as work. But there's someone in the camp who's got some members, right? I mean, there's someone in the camp with embers.
There must be someone in the camp who has, exactly. I mean, why would it be that difficult? So that's one way of reading it. The other way of reading it is that, it's not a fire, end of story. So, for example, secular friends of mine used to say, today we have a lighter, we have a gas top. It don't work at all. Mm-hmm. I understand that if you read it in that context. But if you read it in the context of what Philo says, I think Philo really got it right on this one. Mm-hmm. He says fire is not work, it's a concept. It's a starter for everything. It's a starter for society. It's a beginner for for many types of work. So it doesn't matter if you have if you start a fire or not. You don't have to have fire in general. Mm. So
the expectation would be, for those who hold to that interpretation, would be that on Friday you would extinguish your fire and there's no fire the following day. You can start a fire again on the first day. So that's what generally what Karaites do. We have a slightly, I mean, based on conversations we've had in the past, I think you and I come to slightly different or very different conclusions. And I
can't remember exactly what we said, but yes, I remember specifically that we had a discussion of interpretations of these verses. But just taking it back to this issue, in the rabbinical world, they actually say lote va'aru, they translate it, because it's basically two verbs we have to look at. And I want to thank, there's a friend of mine, which I don't know if he wants me to mention his name, but there's a friend of mine who opened my eyes to this one. Mm-hmm. He actually showed that there's a difference in between two types of verbs. And one is ba'al and the other one is dalak. And the one means to start a fire and the other one means to allow fire to burn, mm-hmm. to continue burning. And the verb dalak is very, there's like maybe four or five cases in the entire Tanakh that this verb appears, and what he argued, and it makes, to me at least, it makes a lot of sense, I mean, if we look at it that way, is that the tevaru means to allow to burn. Okay? Because if you take this verb everywhere in the Tanakh, it really sounds as if, it sounds that the fire is already burning. On the other hand, the root of dalak, dalet lamed kuf, sounds more like starting the fire. So he argued that what the Torah is saying here is you're not allowed to have the fire burning in general. But again, there are not enough examples of the verb dalak to enable us to understand. But when you compare these two words and when you look at the context where these roots appear, it sounds as if one is when the fire is burning and the other one is actually starting the fire itself. So that's about that. So applications to everyday life. If you take the opinion that you're not allowed to start a fire or not allowed to have a fire burning in general, meaning no fire at all, and everyone in the Jewish world agrees they're not allowed to start a fire, it's just an issue of are you allowed to have it burning or not? Unless someone came up with a new interpretation, unless someone accepted the interpretation, it was just difficult to produce the fire. Then, for example, cooking is forbidden if you'd be cooking with fire. Okay, that might be the twist. Maybe you can cook with a microwave. Maybe you can cook with a non-gas oven, a hot plate, stuff like that. So that's one side of it. Is cooking specifically the issue of fire, or is it also the effort you have to put into making food? By the way, as a professional cook, for me, cooking in the kitchen, for example, on Shabbat, will be a type of work because it's my profession. But for men who do not cook, you have to understand something very simple. If your wife is making dinner, sometimes it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it is a type of work. I mean, if you're allowed to cook during Shabbat and you're going to tell your wife, go cook, or you're going to tell your servant, go cook, you tell them to work.
Mm.
Okay, so regardless to the defined definitions of fire, not fire, producing food, not producing food, you also have to remember there's an aspect of actually working.
Yeah, so planning an elaborate, time-intensive, or labor-intensive meal is probably not the kind of thing you would do for Shabbat.
Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. So before we jump off this particular chapter, this verse.
Well, we're far from jumping off. There's a lot of details here. Some of the applications here specifically, for example, can you drive your car? Now, yeah. I've heard people argue, there's no combustion in a car. People, open up a four-cylinder.
There is combustion.
There's videos on YouTube. Someone put a camera into an engine. There's clear fire there. There's nothing. Oh.
There's combustion.
You know, you can see a fire.
It's obvious, yeah.
So people hold that you're not allowed to start a fire. Do not drive your cars, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, there's something very, very important here that we have to remember. And I've had this argument with friends, and it becomes uncomfortable at one point and very embarrassing sometimes. But people, you have to understand, what you might think is not work might be actual work. So you have to be very, very careful with this, mm-hmm. okay? The major problem with the issue of Shabbat is the definition of work. It is a lot more complex than what people think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've heard people say, this is not work. Dude, you're actually making money off of this now. Okay, so one of the definitions is also if you make a profit off of it. There's these definitions you can look at. So
now, there, very again, quickly, that's another no-brainer. Basically, if you could boil it down, you'd be saying you're making a profit off it. You're making money from it.
So it can be either – I try to boil it down to two things.
Mm-hmm.
Life-sustaining activity. When I mean life-sustaining activity, I mean basically what you do in everyday life to have your household carrying on, having your life carrying on. You know, life-sustaining activity doesn't include, for example, eating and drinking and stuff like that. That's not what I mean. Mm-hmm. But I mean work types of activities you do to have your everyday life carrying on.
To maintain your lifestyle, sure.
To maintain your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Go to the supermarket. Doing work on your car, doing work on your house, stuff like that. Mm. I know that a lot of people say, oh, it's you can you have a Shabbat and you're going to start working in your garage to do something.
Mm-hmm.
We consider that to be forbidden because you're not focusing on the concept of resting. You're still active, and that's not resting.
The second
one is basically a profit, making profit off of it.
Yeah.
If you're buying and selling, for example, do not go to eBay. Do not go to Amazon during Shabbat because you're buying and selling. That is forbidden. That's actually in the verses themselves.
Yes.
There's even the verses in, I think it's in Jeremiah. It says, Asot Chefetz. There's a concept of Asot Chefetz. There's actually an Akkadian interpretation of it, which means to go to do merchandise,
mm-hmm.
to go work in merchandise. So there's like subtleties in the verses themselves where you see that that was considered to be a type of work. But really, one of the things we have to think about is what did they do for work in the ancient world? And we need to boil it down. Either people were working in the field, people either worked in the market, worked in the field, worked with the herds, or had their own business.
Mm-hmm.
And women did the everyday work they did at home, which was sewing, dyeing things, weaving, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, if a woman sits down and says she's going to do some sewing or stitching during Shabbat, no, you're not allowed to. That's a form of work for women, at least 2,000 years ago.
Now, this is a question that I have. We're talking 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, even more, obviously, we're talking Exodus. What, in your opinion, how big a part did fire have to play in as much as community work was concerned?
A lot. I mean, not only cooking, but it had to do with... first of all, fire was the symbol of civilization, just mm-hmm. so you should know. Mm-hmm. Symbol of civilization. If you had no fire, you were uncivilized. But it keeps you warm. People would commune around a fire. It was what you used to heat up anything you need heated up, which include producing metal goods of all kinds, dyeing fabrics. There's so many things they did with fire. I mean, mm-hmm. I can't even start. There were many things, and it was a light that they used throughout the night. The sun set around 5 o'clock. The streets were dark by
then. The question becomes then, and I believe you. I think you're absolutely right. So the question becomes, just reading it again from verse 2. This is chapter 35 of Exodus. Work shall be done for 6 days, But the seventh day shall be holy day for you, a holy day, a Sabbath of rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. And taking into consideration that fire was such a major part of community work in those days, the following verse says, you shall kindle no fire throughout your dwellings on the Sabbath day. Is it fair to conclude, because this is a conclusion that I've heard a number of times, and I'm sure you probably have as well, that this kind of the fire that is being referred to here in verse 3 is in the context of work. It's work-related fire. Is that fair?
It's fair to say that. I agree.
It's possible.
It's possible. It is. It is possible. It is possible. Is fire actually in the context of work itself? And if you light a fire just to have a fire burning, who cares? That might be true. I mean, again, this is one of the major problems we have, and this is one of the things that rabbis were trying to solve throughout the centuries.
But I remember the conversation that you and I had, I guess, a couple of months ago now. We agreed that if hypothetically speaking, if that was the interpretation of verse 3, it eliminates the need for the entire discussion that we just had.
True, I agree.
We don't need to be pedantic about that. And I let me just say, I'd like to take the opportunity to say I really like your definition of what Shabbat boils down to, that you're not allowed to engage in. I mean, I'm just saying I agree with you wholeheartedly to engage in activity that serves to maintain your lifestyle, buying and selling or making a profit. I think that really does kind of sum it up. But let's continue into the nitty-gritty of Shabbat.
When you sum that up in that way, it changes everything.
Mm.
So, for example, in the Orthodox world, you're not allowed to use electricity, and specifically here is electricity is produced with fire.
Well, that's another thing. That's another thing that's been in the news lately is kosher electricity.
They didn't let that pass. It didn't pass at all. I don't really know what it means, kosher electricity. I've never really understood that definition. Can we eat this electricity? I don't know. No, kosher doesn't necessarily always have to mean something to do with eating. A lot of things means it's okay. Kasher means that it's okay. The word kasher
means it's rabbinically approved, if you like.
Yeah, but the word kasher or kosher, like many say, is really a means it's okay. I think it's either Aramaic or Persian, which means it's okay. It's acceptable. But for example, you walk into an Orthodox family, you know, it's kind of boring. No TV, no music, no computer. So there's a lot of emphasis on studying.
Sure.
Which, by the way, is something that people did do in the Second Temple period. Mm-hmm. We'll get that to the next time. We'll talk about that. Maybe
sure.
Three times.
Now, listen, before we jump off, because I was going to go to Numbers chapter 15, but we've moved past Exodus 16, and I just want to jump back there for a second because we've jumped over another question that often gets raised when one talks about Shabbat. And I do believe it is in Exodus 16. I'm just looking for it now, but there is the idea that you're not allowed to leave your dwelling. Do you know which verse that is? I'm just going to look for it.
But yes, that has to do with the manna. When they're told to collect the manna, they're told not to leave their dwelling. That also has different interpretations. I mean, I used to go by one thing, and then when I realized what we were really talking about, it changed the whole idea. So we're looking at let me open up my Bible. it's Exodus 16.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically verse 28.
28, okay, I've got it.
28 onwards.
Okay, so what it says, at least in mine, it says, and the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Shabbat. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day, bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day.
So the context here is going out to fit the field to go collect the manna.
Mm-hmm.
In the practice of Jews, and we're talking even the Second Temple period, Jews which were not Pharisaic Jews, the practice was not to leave the immediate area of your dwelling, which meant with different practices, but for example, in the Orthodox world, you're not allowed to leave the area of 2,000 cubits, which is just under a kilometer, which is probably something like two-thirds of a mile, more or less. It's mm-hmm. calculated up to 960 meters. That's one practice. The Qumran sect had a practice of not more than 1,000 cubits, which is about mm-hmm. 450 meters, which is just under half a kilometer. So there were different practices, but we see that already at that time that they prohibited actually exiting the area that you live in.
Uh-huh.
Probably the original practice was you're not allowed to go walk out to your orchards, you're not allowed to walk out to your fields, your Shabbat. That's probably the original practice, because why would I care if I walk out and I take a stroll? Why would that be work? Why can't, I live in a village and there's like a nice place I can sit there and look at the view. Mm-hmm. It's just, beyond the, it's a half an hour walk away,
Sure.
Why is that considered to be work? What's work in this? So I used to practice this very seriously. Don't leave the area of your city. When I say dwelling, when it says dwelling, it doesn't mean your house. And there's this rumor that Karaites, for example, don't leave their house during Shabbat. I don't know if that's true. As far as I know, it's not. But mm-hmm. There might be some that practice it that way. Dwelling, first of all, the word used here is makom, which means place. So I don't think that's what it means. I think that it means not to leave the dwelling of your city. But the question is, what is the purpose of leaving the dwelling of your city? So one of the things we have to think about, the issue of work, is what is purpose as well? What is the purpose of doing a certain action? That's part of it. So, for example, going on your computer during Shabbat. If you go on your computer during Shabbat, I, for example, don't. If you go on your computer and you're just, surfing, studying with it, whatever, that's one thing. But if you go on your computer and the purpose of buying and selling, that's already a problem.
Yes, so that's a problem. But am I to understand, well. I mean, because in the context of this chapter, we're talking about people going out and collecting manna, right? Am I to understand that what you're suggesting is that it may just simply be, don't go out to collect the manna, remain in your house.
Exactly.
Remain in your dwelling. Don't go out searching, gathering the manna, this and that on the Shabbat. Remain in your dwelling area. Just chill.
Exactly. But in the rabbinical mindset, you can't go out because it's similar to the issue of going out to collect the manna. So you don't go out at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like funny. But what Moses here is actually saying, stay inside the camp.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because if you go out, there is a kind of balance here. It's very difficult to fully keep that. He's basically telling them, stay inside the camp.
Mm-hmm.
Going out is not the actual work itself, but if you go out, it's going to look like as if you're going to be working.
Sure.
I'm not too sure. I'm saying this is very, a lot of these verses are very, you can play with them a lot.
I mean, to be honest, Yoel, I have to say that's the first time I've heard it explained that way, and now that just makes so much sense to me, at least.
It makes a lot more sense. It made a lot more sense to me when it was explained to me.
And I can hear everybody breathing a sigh of relief, because I can't tell you how many times people have said, am I allowed to travel 2 hours to be with like-minded believers that we can fellowship and we can worship God and so on and so forth. Can I do that on Shabbat?
Yeah, but you have the issue with the car.
Yeah, you have the issue with the car and the car.
No, are you allowed? If you can walk there, the answer is yes.
Yeah, and then we find ourselves
taking your car, you have a problem.
In 35 verse 3, unless, like we mentioned, unless you interpret it with its context and say that we're talking about work-related fire.
Exactly. So I just to clarify this again, I forbid driving a car during Shabbat very, mm-hmm. very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't want anyone kind of walking up and say, but you all said that. No, what I said was, you can interpret this way, but my answer is, no, you are not allowed to drive your car during Shabbat. Mm-hmm. And I've had this discussion several times with different people, and that's my clear response. You're not allowed to drive your car during Shabbat. End of story. Because mm-hmm. there's combustion in the engine.
That's your that's what you've concluded from that passage. Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Yeah, that's really what I have to say about this, about the issue of fire. I mean, fire is a big issue. Fire is one of the biggies because it's stated in the verses themselves. So it's one of the biggies. But there's a lot of details that we can start going into, which we might next time maybe do.
Well, do you want to? Do we have time to jump? I mean, I know we've gone on, but I mean, do you want me to jump to Numbers 15, or shall we kick off again with that in the next?
I think we should kick off again with that one next time.
All right.
because really, as you noticed, we just spoke about one and a half things. And
yeah,
we're over an hour already.
There it is. There it is. It is. We've been speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo, my Hebrew teacher. His email is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. If you would like Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man. And again, I thank you so much for your time coming back onto the program to discuss some of these things. And we've been promising, haven't we? We've been promising that we're going to talk about Shabbat. And so I'm really glad that that you've made time to do that. And I'm looking forward to getting into part two, of which I suspect is going to be part three and four as well. But we'll see how we go.
It might. And I want to thank everyone out there for the kind remarks on the comment section and the emails I've received from people. Very supporting. I have not received too many questions, or maybe like 2-3 questions that arrive, and I try to answer them as best as I could. We'll be elaborating. So when it comes to the issue of Shabbat, because we've planned this for a very long time, and this is a very broad issue, if anyone has any specific questions regarding Shabbat, just send them either as the comment section that Jonah would be able to look at them and incorporate them into the discussions. You can also send me an email and ask me to bring this subject up on the discussions as well.
In the next discussion.
And, before I forget. Okay, we did the whole Hanukkah thing. Someone sent you an email asking about what oils I suggest using. And you forwarded that to me, and unfortunately, I just did not find time to answer that email. So first of all, I apologize to that person. I hope now that you're going to be able to listen to this answer. The answer to this question is very simple. If you can get a hold of a good frying olive oil, then that's the best, okay? Because vegetable oil is healthy, but not that healthy. Specifically, soy oil is very, very bad for you. I would suggest, sesame oil, sunflower oil. They're all very, very good and actually healthier for you.
Yeah.
There is a type of frying olive oil. I just don't know what they do to it chemically.
I know
families that use it and they claim it's healthier.
What about rice oil? Rice bran oil?
I've never seen rice oil. I've seen a lot of different strange oils. I've never seen rice oil.
Rice bran oil. But sesame seed oil and sunflower oil. But yeah, I've never seen that particular type of olive oil that you're referring to, and I don't know that it's readily available here. But I guess it must be somewhere. But conventional olive oil is not good, right?
Conventional olive oil. The problem with conventional olive oil is that its burning point is very, very low.
Mm. So it becomes carcinogenic.
It burns at a very low temperature, and then you have free radicals. It's very, very unhealthy.
So to be safe, sunflower oil and or sesame seed oil. But you can look these things up on the web and just see what their burning point is and see how carcinogenic they can be. But it's you know, a lot of people don't even think about that. They think, hey, olive oil is a good thing to put on your salad, must be okay to cook with, but it's not necessary.
There are a lot of people like that. I've had arguments with people in families who are very healthy and very organic and la-di-la-di-la-di-la, and they argued with me, is it healthier? No, you're burning it.
Mm.
This stuff burns.
Mm.
Very, okay. Very quickly.
Okay. And then you're eating it. So it's a valid question. It's a valid question. So there you go.
Yeah, it's a valid question, 100%. So again, I do apologize to that person, which I don't even remember their name because I saw the email once and I never go around to doing it. I'm corresponding with several people at the moment, asking questions and everything. So sometimes there's certain emails with some mistake
through the cracks. But even so, there's a cooking tip from the Ninja Chef, Yoel Ben Shlomo, and you have been listening to Truth to You with Jono. Remember, you can download these programs freely from the website, and if these programs have been a blessing to you, please consider showing your support by donating at truthtoyou.org. That's truth2u.org. In the meantime, my friends, until part two of Shabbat, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.